Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield and this is Drop Dead Serious. After nearly 6 weeks. 6 weeks of testimony, 80 witnesses, more than 300 exhibits, and now 4 days of meeting in the deliberation room. That jury is having a tough time. The one deciding Lindsay Clancy's fate. And they decided to tell the judge, no can do, Your Honor. We're stuck. We can't agree. They're divided. And they sent the note. It came this morning. I'm doing this on September 1st. Happy September. And they said, Judge, we've done 18 hours, just about 18 hours of deliberations, and we can't come to an agreement. Okay, so most people draw this deep breath, clutch their pearls, and think, oh God, there it is. Everything's done. Gone. It's over. Never. Just never over. That only is like part of it, right? Their note was very short, by the way, and it didn't leave any note for interpretation in case you're wondering what they were deadlocked on. I'm going to read it to you. It said, quote, and it's short, so don't get your drink yet. Quote, after many hours of deliberation, we are unable to come to a unanimous decision. 18 hours. I'm going to tell you right now, 6 weeks is a long trial. And my friend Vinny Politan, who I've known for like 20 years since Court TV, worked with him many, many years. He had something called Politan's Theorem. And honest to God, it was a good one. And he always said, you can pretty much do the rule of thumb here. For every week of testimony during the trial, you can expect a day of deliberations. We've been 6 weeks in this trial, in the evidentiary phase. But only 3 to 4 days of deliberations. The first one was kind of short, 18 hours. I don't know if you've ever had an 18-hour work week. I sure haven't. But this isn't actually a very long deliberation. And I know it feels long. It certainly feels long for Lindsay Clancy. But it isn't long. There was a lot to go over, right? I think I said it before. 300 exhibits, 80 witnesses, the amount of trial transcript, if they get transcript, I don't know if they do. Sometimes they can ask for it and get it. There's a lot for them to consider. There's a lot for them to discuss. So we don't know how this jury is divided. And that is really important because if you got a 6-6 split, that's really hard to come out of deadlock. 11-1, not so hard. 10-2, really not that hard. 9-3, you can still get a change in opinion and you can get a verdict. Beyond that, it gets a lot harder. But let me tell you, I've been to this rodeo a lot, like a lot. I can't tell you how many Allen charges. And again, it's different in every jurisdiction. It's a dynamite charge, is common parlance, right? Kleenex. I know it's not the brand name, but I always say I grab a Kleenex. So dynamite charge. Basically, that is the common parlance for the judge saying, not so fast. Off you go, back you go, give it another shot. And I've seen trials where there have been multiple dynamite charges, like multiple times the judge has said, sorry, keep trying. You can't do it forever. And you can't badger them either, because that could be grounds for appeal. But I got to tell you, more trials than not result in an actual verdict after an Allen charge, from my perspective. And again, I've been doing this for decades. I'm always astounded that's all it took, just reminding them. But it's really interesting to see the jury instruction, the actual language of the dynamite charge, the Allen charge. In this particular jurisdiction, it has another name. It's called the Tui-Rodriguez charge. Tui was a case, Rodriguez was a case. They amalgamated the language in Massachusetts. So it's all the same thing. It's basically telling the jurors, look, listen to each other in there. Don't abandon how you feel and your core principles just to get a verdict. That's not what I'm asking. Just go in there and talk it over again, but do it with an open mind. There are 12 of you with 12 different life experiences. You need to hear each other's. That's basically my version of what the judge says in very formal language. I can't tell you about Lindsay Clancy's jury split. Like, I don't know what they're split about. Like, are they split over murder versus manslaughter? Is that what they're deciding? Or is the sticking point criminal responsibility? Maybe six of them are like, hey, give her a break. She clearly was legally insane. And the others are like, are you kidding me? Maybe that's what they're fighting over. I can tell you one thing I don't think they're fighting over. The fifth one, not guilty at all. Yeah, I'm really, really certain there's not one person on that panel that thinks it should be not guilty at all. If there is someone on that panel, I'm just going to say it. That is a very unreasonable thing to think. She herself says she did it. Wasn't a whodunit. She says she did it. She did it. She killed her kids. It's just why. So this is the interesting thing. We can't tell you if it's I believe in first, I believe in second, I believe in the manslaughter, I believe in the not guilty because she was criminally insane or not responsible, and I believe in the she's not guilty at all. Nothing to do here. Let's all go home. I can't tell you where those jurors are. And it would be kind of freaky if there were a couple of jurors on each of those charges, right? So there is somebody who knows a lot more about this than I do because she's a judge. Yeah. Judges see it all. Judges have to do this. Judges have to look at juries and say, not so fast. Off you go. Get back in there. Do your thing. And they've got to be very careful in the way they say it, lest they cause, an issue for appeal. And Judge Ashley Wilcott is one of those people who knows a thing or two. And so I called her just to sort of ask her about all the different life experience she has in the courtroom with juries that come back saying, sorry, judge, thanks for spending all that money and time and energy on this trial, but no can do. That's a really hard thing for a judge to hear because, my God, these things are so difficult. Trials are so hard to coordinate. Getting all those witnesses to come in and put their lives away, traveling, paying for it. All of the work the prosecutors do, all of the work the defense attorneys do. I mean, there's just millions of dollars in billable hours and evidence and work coordination. The courts themselves in coordinating trials, 6 weeks of court time, all the staff that it takes to pull off court time, so judges never want to hear hung jury. Look, sometimes it's unavoidable. I get it. But because they don't want to have a hung jury, Judge Sullivan, in this case, brought the jurors in Lindsay Clancy's trial back into the courtroom. And this is what Judge Sullivan said. Now, it's an interesting thing in Massachusetts. You don't just dynamite right away. You don't just Allen charge right away or Tui Rodriguez right away. You gently ask if they can just, head back in and give it another go round. And this is how the judge actually said it. I know this was a long trial, the judge said. I know that there were over 80 witnesses, there were over 300 exhibits, but because of that, I'm going to ask you to go back out. And they did. Do you want to know why that's such significant language? Like, I love the way the judge said that. Because the judge can't say legally, the judge cannot say, hey, we spent a lot of money on this effing trial, so give us a damn result. Judge can't say that because that would be coercion and that would be a ground for appeal. But this is a nice way of reminding them of all of that. Hey, I know this was a long trial and that there were over 80 witnesses and 300 exhibits, AKA for you to go through, but AKA that we compiled at a great expense. But because of that, I'm going to ask you to go back out. So that was a very gentle way of the judge saying, you're just going to have to give it another shot. What the judge did not do was actually read that dynamite instruction, because it's a jury instruction, right? This Allen charge in some jurisdictions, the Tui Rodriguez here in Massachusetts, the common parlance, again, this dynamite charge. The judge did not read this. That comes next. That comes after. If this jury comes back again and says, I'm sorry, judge, I know you asked us to, but we just can't do it, then they'd get the charge. Okay. So this jury, after this very kind reminder to give it another shot was given to them, they deliberated for just about another 5 hours. And so that brought the total number of hours from the beginning of deliberations to 22. 22 hours they've been talking amongst themselves. Remember the work week? If your work week is average these days, it's 40 hours. So they've kind of been at half a work week, 2.5 days, 2.5 8-hour days of deliberations. And we're 6 weeks into this trial. So by Vinnie Politan's Politan theorem, they should be at it 6 days before they really have exhausted all possibilities of discussion on this one. So we're not even halfway there. Again, by Vinnie's theory, and it is a good one, it often actually works. It's so weird. We go into jury deliberations. People say, well, how long will this take? And I usually say, well, according to Vinnie Politan, one day for every week of testimony. So when they were at their wit's end, you know, at the end of the day, after the 22-hour mark, 5 more hours after the judge said, off you go, try again, they asked to go home for the day. And there were no additional notes, no requests for a piece of evidence or transcript, and no verdict. No verdict, no request for help, no announcement, sorry, we tried again and we can't do it. So instead, they will come back again tomorrow morning. That would be Wednesday, September 2nd, and they will start from where they left off, in that jury room by themselves, with nobody to guide them and lead them other than themselves and the foreman that they chose amongst them. So as of right now, we officially have a jury that says they're deadlocked, but still talking. They're still talking. And they are not officially a hung jury. Not yet, not for a while. And also no mistrial. Not for a while. Not for at least a Tui Rodriguez while, right? But I will say this. If they get their dynamite charge, their Allen charge, their Tui Rodriguez charge, whatever you want to call it, and they go back and they work again, and they come back to the judge, and they say, it's just not working. Well, then you can't go further than that. At least no judge really would want to. And Massachusetts doesn't encourage it because that could be considered coercion. And again, if they do come back with a verdict, it can be appealed. It can be appealed. Not that it will be. So the judge basically would have to consider at that point that further deliberations are pointless. And that's when a judge would say this is a mistrial. A mistrial would mean this trial ends without a verdict. And the prosecutors then faced with this very expensive reality of trying the case all over again. Or maybe instead they would say, let's negotiate a plea agreement because, oof, what if this happens again? Maybe they take some other kind of path forward. But what does this deadlock tell us about the prosecution's case? Is the jury likely divided over criminal responsibility or the degree of the homicide? Is it so bad? First degree, is it not great? Second degree, and oh, it's manslaughter, but she should do some time, but we understand maybe why it happened. She should be able to get out one day, though. How hard can the judge push these jurors, right? How forceful can the language be, the tone of voice, before it's then something that becomes an appellate issue because it's considered coercive by some? Well, for that, again, I turn to an old friend and a colleague and somebody who's just really, really smart at this stuff, Judge Ashley Wilcott. And here's our conversation. Judge Wilcott, it's so good to have you on the show. Thank you for joining Drop Dead Serious.
Ashley, I'm so happy to be on with you. I've always admired you and I love being on your podcast. Thank you.
Oh, sweetheart. And by the way, A on the name. Good one.
I know, right? It's perfect.
Let's talk about Lindsay Clancy and this jury. I don't think this is a whole long time to be deliberating. I always talk about Vinnie Politan's theorem of one day of deliberations for every 1 week of testimony. And is that fair? Do you think that's a fair assessment? Or do you think, look, when they're deadlocked, they know it?
Well, I'm never going to take away from Vinnie Politan, number one. But number two, here's the thing about the deadlock, and a lot of people have been commenting on this. So we know that they were going 17-plus hours when they first came out and said, we cannot reach a unanimous decision. And the judge said, well, you got to go back. You've heard all these witnesses, 300 pages of documents or exhibits, 300 exhibits, 80 witnesses. Go on back and keep deliberating. And do you know, we spoke with someone today, Ashley, that was inside that courtroom, and she is a journalist, and she said that when he told the jury this, they didn't look discouraged. They didn't look like mad, but instead they were a little bit like, all right, we'll go back and keep deliberating. And that's what they've done. So they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. It's what the system is designed to do. And we just don't know what they might come back with in the morning when they're fresh.
You know, it's interesting because when people who aren't steeped in criminal procedure watch these cases and they hear about a deadlocked jury, their mind goes to, well, they've been at it and at it and at it and they know the drill, so this is terrible news. But the truth is, they've never been at it before. This is their very first time usually in a deliberation, in a jury box, in a courtroom, and they don't know. How long are we supposed to decide on this? If we do a once around vote and we all are split, do we send the note out? So they're kind of learning as they go along as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They have no idea what to do if they can't reach a decision, because they know they were told to go reach a decision. And so it is a weird thing to think. They come out, we say, we can't reach an agreement, and the judge says, go back and try again. Let me tell you, in Massachusetts, and you probably well know this, Ashley, what happens next. Let's say they come back in the morning, and they come back again and say, judge, we cannot reach a unanimous decision. And then the judge delivers the first Allen charge, dynamite charge, but in this particular state, it's called a Tui Rodriguez, and it's very specific as to the language, and it says, keep an open mind, listen to the others, go back and keep trying. Let's say they come back one more time and say, okay, we've tried. We cannot get this right. We cannot get a, not that it's not right, I didn't mean to say that, but we cannot get a unanimous decision. The judge, under the laws and the practice in this state, will read it a second time. Same charge. Second time, they go out again. Now, if they come back after that and say, we still can't reach a verdict, at that point, the judge has to call a mistrial unless the jury consents otherwise to keep deliberating. So that's the process. It's a little long and drawn out, but it really gives this jury a chance to continue to try to get a verdict.
So the judge just reads the exact same language, exactly the same way. And that would be confounding if I were a juror, almost as though, wait, did that just happen? Because I could have sworn he said that yesterday.
Yeah, you know what you'd think, Ashley? You'd be like, is he listening to us? Like, what is he doing Groundhog Day? Yeah. But it is because, and again, every state's a little different. I will tell you, I've read these charges before, and I read it from a piece of paper. Why? Because it's an appellate issue if I mess up. And so I don't want to do it from my memory, because I'm going to mess up and then it's going to be a big issue. And so maybe this judge knows it. Maybe he won't use a piece of paper. I would. But Massachusetts is very specific about you have to have all the right language in there. And I agree with you, as a jury, it's like, wow, that's kind of weird. Why am I listening to this again? But the thing I want to say is, a lot of people are commenting, and I'm sure you know this because of so many people that listen to you and follow you and tell you what they think. So many people have said to me, hey, by the way, this isn't fair. Who is it for any judge to come back and tell us we can't reach a decision, but we have to go try again? That's kind of bullying, right? And telling us we have to do something we can't do. The reality is, I've seen trials firsthand where it works, because it tells them it's this important that you really go back and really revisit and talk about the evidence and talk about your opinions and see where you are. And it does work. There are times that after that charge, the jury comes back and has a unanimous decision.
I mean, honestly, look, I haven't been in as many courtrooms as you have, and certainly not on the bench, but the trials that I've covered that have had this happen, where a notice come out and said we're deadlocked and some kind of dynamite or Allen charge is read, for my experience, my body of work, the majority of the time it works. The Allen charge actually does bring forth a verdict.
And I'd love to hear you say that, because so many people are upset. I was monitoring chat today just to see what people were saying, and a lot were really upset and said, look, the jury has spoken. They're at an impasse. They can't reach a verdict. Well, no, you got to keep trying. And you're right. It is very effective.
And I think that, again, I come back to the fact that these jurors, God bless them, they're at this for the very first time. They do not know how long they're supposed to be in there. For all we know, they feel embarrassed and upset that they've been wasting everybody's time, because they've been at it 4 days instead of maybe they thought they were supposed to get it done in one. You know, nobody gives them that kind of guidance or tutelage. Again, you can't, because that's appellate, right? That's an appellate issue if you do.
Right.
But I do have to ask you, do you think it's because they're told, hey, bring your common experience, share it with your friends at the table? That's okay to do it. Because for the whole time that they've been in the box, they've been told, don't talk to your fellow jurors.
Well, I think it's a relief. So I did one of these jury studies when I was in law school, where we served as the jury. And honestly, I think we were all sitting, waiting until we could talk about it. And then you go back in the deliberation room. 12 Angry Men is one of my favorite movies, Ashley, because it gives you a real look at what can happen inside that jury room. And then there's a relief that they can talk about it and finally see, like, oh, what do you think? And we talk about juries typically do it one of two ways. Either they always get a foreman first, then they either do a straw poll to say, okay, who thinks it's murder one, murder two, manslaughter, not guilty by reason of she didn't understand the criminality, or not guilty at all. And they take their vote and then they go from there. The other way a jury could approach it and often do is just to start in with the deliberations. And I want to talk about this and this evidence and what about this and the chronological events that the prosecution described, blah, blah, blah. So there are different ways they can approach it. We don't know what's going on in there, but I can tell you the amount of time they've been deliberating and the amount of time they went back and deliberated. I think it was 11:17 that the judge said, you need to go back and keep doing it. And they went from there through lunch to the end of their work day today. That's a long time that they're still talking. So, you know, kudos to them.
Yeah, I always say, look, this is not, this isn't easy for people to put their lives aside. And then, first of all, it's not easy for the timing and the inconvenience, but then to be inundated with the kinds of things that they've been forced to look at. They deserve a medal of honor. Honest to God, anybody who sits through these kinds of trials, they deserve a lot. I want to ask you about the statistics, because I was actually looking before our interview about how many cases that have resulted in a note about deadlock, an Allen-styled charge, and then an actual verdict. And they don't keep any stats. I thought that was a bit loony, but there have to be reasons for it. I suppose, like in law, every case is different. Why do you suppose there aren't some more statistics?
You know why? I think it's simply because there's nowhere that has the incentive to warehouse those statistics. So, for instance, juvenile justice, every state has their own juvenile justice department that keeps those statistics. A lot of national organizations, of course, report about crimes committed, convictions, and demographics of the particular people who are convicted and not convicted. So there are a number of statistics that are kept, but it's like anything, the money's not always there to fund some of the important statistics that could be kept.
And by the way, speaking of money, hung juries are very expensive.
Yeah.
Like there, I think it's probably fair to say, Ashley, you tell me, that there were millions and millions spent over the course of this case, from the moment those children died tragically till the moment the first deadlock note came out. Just the work hours, policing, the courts, prosecutors, defense attorneys, all of it, just millions in lost money and time and treasure.
You know what I love, Ashley? You mentioned something a lot of people forget about, and that is it starts on the day of the death of these children. The investigators, the police force, the overtime, the investigation, all of this is a large amount of money. And then you add to that all of the individuals who are employed, who are working specifically on this case, their hard work, their hours spent, the experts they have to employ. And then in court, you have all of the court staff, you have the judge's time, you have the court reporter, all of these things. You experts, are you kidding me? Millions and millions. And remember, taxpayer dollars pay that. Yes. And so it is a very expensive proposition. Now, one of the discussions is there going to, if there's a hung jury, it's not there yet, if there's a hung jury, will the prosecution try this case again? And I think it really is going to depend on, number one, what the victims in this case want, or what their opinion is. Number two, what the split of the jury is. And so it may be, if it's 6-6, a prosecution could say, listen, we tried it in the community and it was half and half, and we're not going to retry it. Or if there's one person holding out and they could have gotten a guilty verdict but for that one person, they may then say, well, we're going to try it again. We have an obligation, right, for the safety of the community and to uphold the law. We're going to try it again. So we just don't know what they're going to do. It is expensive.
Are you allowed to find out the split?
Yes. Yes, you can find out the split after. You know what? I said that so quickly, Ashley. I'm going to be transparent, and I'm going to look it up as we talk. States are different, but I believe that you can there. So you keep talking, and my little fingers are going to look up my law because I want to make sure.
I think that's the critical issue, right? Like, if I were the prosecutor and I'd put all this time and treasure into it, and then I realized that it was 6-6, meaning my next go-round, I'm going to have to be doubly as good to make sure that I don't get six more jurors who are going to hang another one.
Yes.
You know, I particularly am close to a case in Canada that went three rounds, three trials, you know? So That's why I ask. I feel like if you're not allowed to know the split, that's sort of a bad practice for states.
Right. So I will tell you in Massachusetts specifically that, yes, the attorneys can find out the numerical split of a jury if a mistrial is declared, but it's not automatically made public by the court. So will you and I know? Maybe, maybe not. But the attorneys will know, and that's what's significant.
And that's fair because they're, you know, I'll just say the attorneys on the prosecutor's side, they're footing the bill. They're having to pay for it if they're going to do it again. So in that regard, if it's 6-6 or something like that, or listen, if it's 3-9 against the prosecution, would they then look amongst themselves and say, no more trial, let's offer a deal?
Well, that's a great question. So I would hope rational minds prevail, that they will think about a deal before retrying a case, no matter what the split is. If they're going to retry this case, you should think about a deal first and see whether or not it can be worked out. I mean, somebody said to me, what is justice to you in this case? Well, we all have different opinions about what justice is. For me in this case, based on the evidence, justice for me is either she goes to prison for killing her children, or in the alternative, that she is found not guilty because she didn't understand the criminality of her conduct, and she goes to a state hospital for the care she needs. Now, if she goes to jail, to prison, she still gets mental health care. So it's not as if she's not going to get the treatment she needs. To me, justice is one of those two things happening. And if that can be accomplished, if there's a mistrial without a trial, I would hope those conversations would be had.
So are you saying that any plea that this prosecution would consider would have to include some form of prison time?
No, I'm saying either prison time or a hospital, psychiatric hospital where she gets
the care. I feel like that's a win for the defense. Like,
yes,
Kevin Reddington would die. He would be so thrilled for that win. That's, listen, he wasn't going to get not guilty. Let's be honest. He's not going to get not guilty, but not criminally responsible is a win. So
huge.
Why would a prosecutor then just offer a win?
Well, it depends on the split of the jury. It depends on what the victims want. It depends on the cost and whether or not they want to retry the case. It depends on all of those things. And so the reality, Ashley, is, let's say that 9 people say she needs to be in a hospital for psychiatric care. We don't believe she's criminally responsible, but she needs to be in that. And 3 people say, no, it's guilty. Are they going to take that chance a second time and risk that they're going to have that anyways? But it's so many factors. And I think what's important to recognize is it cannot be decided in isolation. And the hardest job for a prosecution is to weigh all of those factors and decide how to proceed. It would be a win for the defense.
Question for you about something in the instructions. It caught me off guard because, again, in so many of the cases that I've covered in the past, the judges never tell the jurors what could happen to the defendant if they choose guilty, or if they choose not guilty, or if they choose not guilty by reason of insanity, that they're never allowed to inform the jurors of what happens, according to what their decisions are. And yet, in Massachusetts and in this particular case, that was all laid out for the jury, what each of their choices would yield in prison time should they choose it. That's weird, isn't it?
It is weird. Ashley, you and I were just talking about it off air, discussing what this meant, because generally jurors are required to disregard the potential outcomes or penalties when they're deciding guilty or not guilty. Because when you're deciding guilty or not guilty, it doesn't matter what the consequence is. You're just trying to look at the facts and the evidence. And so this is highly unusual.
Do you think it's affected them in the jury room? Meaning, somebody feels for Lindsay Clancy. They looked at her across the courtroom for 6 weeks. They clearly see the wheelchair, that she's already had a severe punishment in her life. And they believe that she's, terribly mentally ill. But they just don't want to see her go away for 20 years or potentially life with the opportunity of parole. Do you think that affects maybe how they make their decisions?
How could it not? That's the reason most places don't allow it. I mean, it just is, how could it not? Because you're absolutely going to be thinking in the back of your mind, wow, well, I really think she's guilty, but boy, that's a pretty stiff sentence. She's already paralyzed. She's lost her 3 children. She does have mental health issues. I really can't live with that consequence. So I think, how could it not?
Okay, do you think it could lead to some of these jurors nullifying, meaning they know what the decision is that they should choose, but they're going with something else because they believe it's right?
I do think it could result in that. And again, I think it's why generally it's not allowed.
Yeah, I'm surprised at it.
Me too.
I'm going to have to do a deep dive on Massachusetts and why they decide and how many other states does the same thing.
Darn you, I've already started my research. So we'll compare notes because I agree with that. It is a question of why they would allow that, et cetera. But, you know, every state's different and you just have to know the state's laws to understand what a jury can and cannot do.
Okay, let's talk about Patrick for a hot minute. We have all seen his statement. I'm going to read it after you and I have a moment to talk. But he is so sensitive and empathetic to his wife and doesn't, I believe, want to see her locked away. I think he wants to see her get, you know, mental health care. And I wonder if the prosecutors, after seeing the split, if it's not in their favor, or even if it is in their favor, but Patrick says, please, no, not again. How much would that weigh on them?
I think it would help the prosecution determine what direction to go. Now, Patrick, he has said he forgives her, and he has filed a civil lawsuit against pharmaceuticals as well as the mental health care that she did not receive, right? And I think that his opinion is going to make a difference. But you got to remember to offset that from a prosecution's perspective. Ashley, you have 3 dead children.
Yeah.
Killed by their mother in the basement with exercise bands. Even though some different rooms, do we really know that one of them didn't see the others get killed? We don't know that. So it's pretty horrific.
Well, I think you're right. It is as horrific as they come, but it does get worse. Andrea Yates's children were strangled face up in the bathtub, and she went from youngest to oldest, which I will never be able to get my head around. That little child, Noah, 7 years old, ran for his life around that house and was found with her hair in his fists, and still the jury came to a conclusion unanimously that she was not guilty because she was criminally insane.
Right. And he literally fought for his life. So you make a really good point, which is the emotional aspect of these cases and that case as well doesn't mean that a jury's not able to look at the facts and the law and come to a decision based on those two things together. It doesn't mean they put their emotion aside, but it does mean they don't make a decision based on their gut. They make a decision based on the facts, the evidence, and what the law tells them to do.
But if a jury in Texas, the same place that gave her, you know, a guilty, I believe it was a death penalty trial.
I'm from Texas, so you are right on the money when you're describing it. Go ahead.
Right? Like, if that jury could see their way with those facts in Andrea's case, face up, 5 babies, the oldest one seeing it all and knowing their fate. I mean, just the worst that it's ever been in my entire career, and I believe in America. If a jury can arrive there, why is it that prosecutors, you know, in Massachusetts can't?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. But there are some real things that the prosecution pointed out that if a person wants to say she's guilty, either murder one, murder two, or manslaughter, she is guilty. Things like sending the husband out to get the medication and the food.
Andrea waited for Rusty to go to work.
All right. So good. This is great. This is the comparison. Yeah. And I think what it shows is every case is specific to the time, to the community, to the system. And you can't always predict what a jury is going to do. But let's go down that path because you know the facts of that case so well. And that is, all right, that's number one. Number two, you know, what about the fact that it took some time to kill each child? And should she have, is it reasonable to think that she had psychosis for each child? Or rather, should she have been like, wow, what am I doing?
Snap out of it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the snap out of it part, I'm okay. I believe if you've made that kind of decision, you're in it. You are deep in it. If you're already killing that first child, I don't think that you're in any kind of shallow psychosis.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And I do think the reality is, no matter what happens, I think we can all agree she needs help. And I think we can all agree our mental health system needs help. We need to do better for all of the people that have, especially these kinds of mental health disorders. We failed her in that regard.
What is prison help like versus state hospital help?
So very different. You know, it's not different in terms of this. Both of them, your freedoms are restricted. You don't get to come and go as you please. You don't get to leave the grounds. You don't get to go somewhere and go do the things you want and then come back at the end of the day and have a lovely little treatment. That's not how it works in either one of those systems. And so there are more liberties and freedoms in a state hospital, because as long as they keep you treated so that you do know right from wrong, and you're not a risk to someone, you do have some more liberties, some more freedoms. The rooms may be nicer. There's a little garden outside. Some of those things might exist. It means you're still restricted. You can't leave sight, but you can do some of those things. The biggest difference is the amount of mental health care, so that you can have all aspects of it. You can have the medication management. You can have the diagnosis. You can have psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, all the things that you need, because sadly, I think, again, we can all say about Lindsay Clancy, she did not get all of the things she needed in spite of her crying out, reaching out and saying, I got some problems going on here.
So I'm sure every state's different, but generally speaking, if you're in prison and you are clearly suffering from a mental health, you know, crisis like Lindsay Clancy has and maybe still is, my guess is that your day is a day as an inmate, and you go and do your either push in or pull out patient treatment. Maybe the hospital is all day long is sort of like treatment.
That's a really good way to look at it, because I do want to be very, very clear. Every prison system, every state, federal, whichever it is, has care for the physical and mental health of inmates, period. Yes. But it's the level of what's available to them. It's the frequency of what's available to them. Those things will be very different in a prison versus the state hospital. And the way you described it is a great way to look at it.
Yeah, because I mean, I think it's fair to say the majority of people who are sitting in a prison have some kind of mental challenge. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in there. And when I say the majority, I want to say like 85%.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's either that or drugs, right? And so then they may or may not get clean while they're in prison, but you're absolutely right.
Okay, let me talk a little bit about the functionality of being in the deliberation room. And again, I know every state is different, but some states will load you up with the exhibits and the transcripts and say, off you go, and you feel like you're in a library surrounded by, you know, 6 weeks of this case. And other states don't let you have anything. And I've seen notes saying, can we have that transcript of that witness? And the judge will say, nope, no, you can't. So tell me a little bit about, I don't know if you know about Massachusetts, or why this massive discrepancy and the reliance on memory. Because if they relied on my memory, I'd be like, no, I don't remember day 16 or 28.
Yeah. So a couple of things. First of all, it's the collective memory. So the goal is when you get back there and start talking to the other jurors as you're deliberating privately in a closed room, that you can remember facts. So you can debate what you do or don't remember versus what someone else may remember or not. So that's the philosophy of you need to rely on your memory. A lot of states do allow note-taking. Massachusetts in this courtroom did. And so we did speak with somebody who was inside the courtroom as a journalist and said they were taking lots of notes, especially when the experts were there. They were taking notes. And so when they go back to the jury room in this specific case, they have all of their notes that they've handwritten. Now, most courts do not, and most laws do not say you have to send everything back with the jury. Here's why. Because that is overly burdensome. We don't know if they need it. Why are you going to send back a transcript or an 8-hour video of an interview for them to watch again? No. If they need it, that's different. But generally, you're not going to see all the evidence goes back immediately. No, it's available. If you need it, you need to come ask. Now, a good example is they wanted the pill bottles and they wanted the knife. And the pill bottles were allowed, the knife was not. Well, safety concerns, right? I haven't been in a courtroom yet where a judge is going to say, great, take the knife back to the jury room. No, that's not really a good idea. Now, I have seen guns, once they've been inspected and a deputy goes and stands outside of the door because they know it's not loaded, et cetera, a little bit different. But really, a lot of this, there are state-specific laws, but sometimes it's up to the discretion of the judge, and they'll hear from the defense and from the prosecution, and then the judge will have to make the decision.
Would they ever consider allowing a knife into a deliberation if, say, the court, you know, staff handled it for them? Or does the court staff have to be out at all times that they're having a chat?
Great question. Here's my familiarity. The court staff cannot be in deliberation room, period. Nobody can. However, what you've seen happen and the way to handle that is, as an option, is to bring the jury back into the courtroom and have the attorney or the bailiff or whoever the court deems appropriate, and you've seen this happen, show the knife. Right? Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right, Ashley. You've seen it happen.
That makes sense, because if Koberger ever went to trial, I really think they'd want to look at the knife a whole lot.
Yes.
And look at the sheath and look and see if it matched and all the rest. I could just see that being the crux of this case, being that the sheath was the crux of the case. So the other question I have for you is, do they ever get a map? And I don't mean that, you know, exactly as I say it, but some kind of, like, I don't know, index or guide. This is how the trial went. These were the days. These were the witnesses. These were the exhibits. Do they get any kind of sort of physical reminders of everything they've been through?
They can take their notes, which they may have written that on. But one of the things I really appreciated about both sides in this case, especially in closing arguments, were their demonstrative aids. So they had things checked off and marked and really visually showed the jury what they were arguing or what their point was. Now, demonstrative aids, and they did it some throughout the trial, perhaps more in the closing, more than they did in closing arguments, but demonstrative aids are not evidence. So frequently, that's not going to be allowed back in the back. Now, if they want to see the evidence again, that's fine. But the hope, I think, of a court is, if they're allowed to take notes, is they're going to do that in a way that it can trigger their memory.
Yeah, and if they ever ask, I know that they must be so disappointed when they're told, no, you can't. Either you can't have that transcript, you can't have that video, or you can't have that amazing sandwich board that spelled it all out for you in, you know, someone else's opinion.
Right, right. No, it's got to be frustrating as a jury. And to your point, they're flying blind. They haven't served, most haven't served on a jury before, and they don't know what they're doing. They're just following the instructions. Now, the other thing I want to say that people forget is a really good roadmap is when the jury instructions are sent back with the jury. Now, that doesn't always happen. Right. But by doing it, I as a judge would, because then they can look at those instructions, they can look at the definitions, and that helps them understand the law.
Hey, how many cases did you have when the first note that came out was, Judge Wilcott, what is the definition of reasonable doubt?
Oh my gosh, right? Even after, you know, most attorneys in opening and closing, they don't prepare them quite as much as they should, unfortunately. And so they focus on that, like the definition of reasonable doubt. If any of you have any doubt at all, if it's not reasonable. And then they do that. You're absolutely right. They always come out with some of those questions, and you just want to say, okay, let's just either listen or read it. But it's, again, the reality of they are drinking from a fire hose of facts, of information, of law. They're not lawyers, generally. There might be one or two. But they have to assimilate a lot of information in a short amount of time.
Yeah, when I started covering courts, I had the same question. Well, how do you define reasonable doubt? Because, you know, everybody has a different version of it, and that's exactly it. Everybody's reasonable factor is a little different, which is why you get hung juries, unfortunately. Yeah. I have a question for you about the language that the judge used. I thought you would particularly love this. So Judge Sullivan brought them back when they said, Judge, we're deadlocked, and said, quote, I know that this was a long trial. I know that there were over 80 witnesses. There were over 300 exhibits. But because of that, I'm going to ask you to go back out. The judge is not allowed to say to this panel, hey, it's really expensive if you make us do this again. But isn't that exactly what he just said?
You know, it was really interesting to me because when it first happened, I thought to myself, uh-oh, let me get back on my little trusty computer because I don't think that counted as a dynamite charge, but I better do research. Well, it didn't. And I didn't think it did. And nobody objected. He did ask both sides after, any objections, any questions? No, no. But he just put in his own words, and I guess there's an argument to your point that, What did that say to the jury? Did that make them biased? Did they take something from that? As a judge, I'm very cautious. I would have read the charge right then and said, okay, let me read the charge for the first time. But that's not Judge Sullivan's choice, and he has managed his courtroom well.
Massachusetts is kind of funky. Apparently, they can't read it right away. They have to wait. Yeah, when the jury comes with one, you know, frustrating note saying we're stuck, they can't read it right away. They just have to say, off you go, try again. And if they come back a second time, then they can read the Tui Rodriguez instruction. I thought it was so interesting that, you know, he wove in the fact that there's 80 damn witnesses and 300 exhibits, folks. This is big. And he wove it in by saying, I know this has been hard on you because of these numbers, as opposed to it's been hard on the state because of these numbers.
Yes. But I also took it another way. I felt like he was almost saying, this is not long enough to deliberate when you have 80 witnesses and 300 documents that have been admitted into evidence. So I also felt like it was kind of an underhanded way to say, yeah, you haven't been back there long enough. You need to go keep talking.
And that's fair because, again, this is their first shot at this. This is their first go around. They don't know. They didn't know if they were pissing everybody off by being out for 4 days. They may very well have thought, oh, God, we're embarrassed by this. I feel terrible. We've gone so long. We don't know. So it's a big relief to them if the judge says, no, 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 there's a lot to look at. And because of that, you need to go back. Could be a real relief to them.
And I think that's why the description of the jurors by someone inside that courtroom reporting on the case, where they weren't downtrodden, they weren't angry, at least they didn't look to be that way. They were more like, all right, let's go deliberate. So I think that's why.
Yeah, nobody flipped in the bird. That's a good one. Okay, next question, and I'm going to ask you to read tea leaves, which is the dumbest thing I could ever do, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you think they're deadlocked between the top charges, or do you think they're deadlocked between the not guilty by reason of insanity and something else?
So, of course, I will start with the disclaimer. We never know what a jury is going to do.
I know.
But I do have this opinion. So, first-degree murder, premeditated, intentional malice. Second-degree murder is that intentional malice. The third, manslaughter, rather, is unlawful killing with malice. And then you go to the insanity, and then you go to the not guilty. I feel like the manslaughter is often the middle ground for a jury when they can't agree. And so they'll often say, well, we all agree it was an unlawful killing. We can at least, even if we didn't 100% think, well, we can kind of meet in the middle and let's give them a verdict. That hasn't happened yet. I feel like there are some polar opposites in this group. Now, I don't know if it's one, I don't know if it's three, I don't know if it's 10, but I'm just saying, I think it's between two very significant set of facts, and I think the evidence supports either one. It's either that first-degree murder, this was deliberate, this was planned, it was premeditated, and she's guilty of first-degree murder. But I also think the evidence, if you want to choose this, does support that she is not guilty because she didn't understand or recognize the criminality of her actions. And I think those are the two on which they're stuck. I don't know that. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like with a big, fat, juicy compromise burger sitting there and neither side has taken a bite, or at least someone's not taking a bite, it does make me feel like there's some intransigence in polar opinions because, again, like, and maybe, by the way, maybe this is what will get them there when the judge says, no, 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 keep chatting, keep talking, keep deciding, keep discussing. Maybe they felt like they couldn't do that. Maybe they felt like they were not allowed to compromise and come to a middle ground. They either had to be convinced of one charge or they couldn't move to something maybe a little off where their convictions are.
And that's what happens. And that's to your point when you said, listen, a lot get resolved by the Allen charge and they come up with a verdict. And that's why the court gives them permission to compromise, to reassess, to go on to the other side in order to reach a verdict.
Okay, I'm going to get you to read tea leaves again, which is absolutely verboten in what we do, but it's fun parlor game anyway. Do you think we're going to end up with a hung verdict here or hung jury?
You know, I'm just going to say this, and again, it's strictly my opinion. I did not watch every minute of the trial. I watched a significant amount of the trial, and I will tell you, I walked away and said, wow, I could see the facts supporting either narrative, the prosecution or the defense. And as I thought through it and slept on it, I said, I don't know that 12 people are going to be able to be unanimous about that. Now that we've had one at 17 hours and something minutes, we can't agree, and they've been deliberating longer and still haven't agreed, I think it's leaning towards, even with the dynamite charges that we expect to come if they can't reach a verdict, I still think we're leaning towards a hung jury. Again, that's just my opinion.
We're both going to have to call Vinnie Politan on this and ask him what his thoughts are at this. Like,
and how long it's going to take.
Right. His theory has us about halfway at this point. But
right.
Listen, I'm just such a fan, and I'm so thankful that you gave me your very precious and valuable time.
Thank
and I
you.
Hope you will consider doing it again early and often.
Anytime. I really appreciate you, Ashley. I love the way you shine a light in a great conversation. So thank you.
Thanks, Judge Ashley.
We'll see ya.
My great thanks to Judge Ashley Wilcott. I knew she was going to know all the ins and outs of what it's like sitting on the bench when that jury comes back. I always say I'd love to be a fly on the wall, and then you get to talk to Judge Ashley Wilcott. So great thanks to her. Also, I promised you that I would read you Patrick Clancy's statement. This was on the GoFundMe page back in 2023, about 4 days after his children were killed. So listen, 4 days after his babies are killed and he discovers them, you would imagine that emotions would be extremely raw, but he has come to this decision to post these words. And the reason I say this is because this may be the kind of statement he gives to the prosecutors if they decide that the deadlock, if there's an eventual permanent deadlock, is at a split that doesn't look like they can overcome it in a retrial, and that they may want to offer a plea deal. And they would consult Patrick. He's one of the victims of all of this. The children are victims and he's the dad, right? So this is what he wrote, again, 4 days after the killings. I want to share some thoughts about Lindsay. She's recently been portrayed largely by people who have never met her and never knew who the real Lindsay was. Our marriage was wonderful and diametrically grew stronger as her condition rapidly worsened. I took as much pride in being her husband as I did in being a father, and felt persistently lucky to have her in my life. I still remember the very moment I first laid eyes on her, and I can recall how overcome I was with the kind of love at first sight that you only see in movies. It really didn't take long before I was certain I wanted to marry her. We said I love you to each other multiple times a day as if it were a reflex. We habitually started every morning with a passionate hug, yielding a sigh of relief like we had each received the perfect medicine. If too much time passed without a hug, she'd look at me and ask, "Did you forget?" We mutually understood the reality that people can have bad days, but we stuck to the rule that when one of us got lost, the other was always there to bring them home, always. She loved being a nurse, but nothing matched her intense love for our kids and dedication to being a mother. Remember, this is 4 days after she has killed those kids. He's writing this. So talk about commitment, right? It was all she ever wanted, in fact, being a mother. Her passion taught me how to be a better father. I want to ask all of you that you find it deep within yourselves to forgive Lindsay as I have, 4 days, just 4 days after the killings. The real Lindsay was generously loving and caring towards everyone, me, our kids, family, friends, and her patients. The very fibers of her soul are loving. All I wish for her now is that she can somehow find peace. So, you know, 4 days after the killings, that's how Patrick feels about the person who killed his children. Would he say the same things to prosecutors now if they confer with him, if we end up at a hung jury? And how much will his words weigh, you know, into their decision to whether they offer a plea deal or whether they just go barreling straight towards a second trial asking for the same choices on a verdict form? I also want to tell you this, that Kevin Reddington, he's been very vocal outside of court. It's a media scrum around him. And God, he was really upset over the weekend. He just took the piss out of a couple of journalists, angry AF, saying that they lie, they say things that aren't true, they make up evidence, saying, I think one of the things he criticized was a journalist who said, Lindsay Clancy Googled how to kill her children. And he said that didn't happen. It just didn't. And so he's really frustrated with some of the media coverage that the case has gotten. I don't even know how much of it he's taken in because he's been at trial every day. That's so busy. But man, oh man, if he went onto social media, I wonder what he'd say. Some of the stuff, like the conspiracy theorists who say that Patrick did this. If you're one of them, please meet me at camera two. Oh, you're back here? Okay. Well, please just disabuse yourself of that. Patrick didn't do this. I just don't understand why that got legs. You need to hear Patrick's 911 call. And sadly, he wanted it suppressed because it showed the rawest terror and fear and horror in a man's heart, discovering your children dead and your wife almost dead. But I think if you could hear it, you'd probably feel very differently about whether he did it or not. Hey, listen, thank you so much, everybody, for watching. Make sure you subscribe because the minute there's a verdict, yeah, I'm coming in here. We're going to talk. And if there isn't a verdict, in fact, it's funny. Hung juries are often called a verdict. It's just a verdict that doesn't have a guilty or not guilty in there. But obviously, I'm going to watch really closely. I want to know in the comments what you think the jury is thinking, where you think the jury may be hung up. Or if you think the jury's just so new at this, they're just not sure how long they should actually be going. And if they're upset that maybe they're keeping us. And that we're annoyed that they're in there so long, right? Everybody's brand new at this, so we got to give them grace. Thanks again for watching. Thanks again for listening. And remember, truth isn't just serious, it's drop dead serious.